FactWallet Show this week, Rights and Recourse. Hi, I'm Christia, and I'm not entirely sure that I'm saying recourse right.
No, it's recourse.
With me, the person who knows how to say recourse, Simon Brown.
No, the person who has an opinion. I don't know how to say it. Big difference.
If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleep version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. On the 31st of October, we'll finally be doing a live recording in Cape Town at the JSE. Where is the JSE in Cape Town?
155 Campground Road.
And we will be there.
That is opposite Newlands Cricket Ground.
We'll be there from 5:30. We'll rent a big rental so that we can put all the wine that you guys are going to bring us there to bring home.
Oh, then we're going to have to drink it. Because you're going to budget fly.
Oh, maybe we should drive back. If we get enough wine, we can road trip it back. Do like a drunken trip.
I've done some bad wine road trips on that. No. It's a long way. And then you get hungover somewhere around like Colenso.
No, if you get hungover, you're not drinking enough.
Yeah.
You have to maintain the buzz the entire way. That's how it works. Our price-weighted index is doing so poorly. We're like almost 2% down, 1.87% down, which is like that doesn't sound too bad until you take into account that our benchmark is 1.3% up.
And our preferred ETF is 4.74% up.
Yeah, but that one I don't really want to count because of the currency movement. It's difficult to see what is performance and what is currency movement with those international ETFs.
You're just picky. I just like money.
Yeah, thank goodness we're not invested in this thing. The Zacwan Lab Index is 6.28% down. Why is that doing so badly? What is this down 47%?
Yeah, I don't know. Down 47%.
What is that? Sasol?
Oh.
What is going on at Sasol? Is it that international thing that was such a disaster?
Yeah, that one.
And this one is also...
Okay, but I want to say it, the ethane cracker plant. It's a really, really cool phrase of words, but...
Netcare is down 40% and EOH is down 73%. What happened with EOH?
They fell over.
Oh, that's awkward.
I can give you the long story if you like.
So give me the pre-seed version of the
story. So they used to grow by acquisition, then you can't because you can't acquire enough, and then some rabbit holes started to appear, and then there was accusations of corruption, and then the price collapsed.
Uh-oh, that's not great.
Nah, not
sorry,
great.
Zach. All right, so
not as half sorry as EOH shareholders, but hey.
Earlier this week, we introduced ourselves to the people at the Education Department at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the FSCA. So these are the people who regulate all of the financial institutions in the country, including like if you want to make a new ETF, you have to get approval from the FSCA. Mm-hmm. You know, whoever is selling financial products to the public legally. So like, you know, not a loan shark, but everybody else has to be registered with the FSCA. And so we were just talking about education and financial education and where that should be going. And then they recommended that we spend a little bit of time on talking about what you can do when you feel like you've been wronged financially. So I was thinking maybe today we could go throughout the financial journey. So from being in debt, like if something goes wrong there and like what are your rights and what can you do? And then your savings. So if your money gets stolen, et cetera, your insurance, your investments, and if you receive bad advice. So let's have this conversation. So what happens? What can you do? Let's say you find out that you have debt that you never took on. So somebody else took out debt in your name.
In your name. So they've committed identity theft. The first point of call is to go to the person who has loaned the money to the person who is not you. In other words, to the provider of the debt. Because you'll know who that provider is. Even if your first awareness of it is when you get contacted by a collection agency, which may be the issue, you then need to go to whoever provided the debt to you and say, hey, you know, you didn't give me this money. Why am I being recorded for having a debt I never had?
Where would you find this out? On a credit score?
Well, actually, you would find it on a credit score. So on a credit...
Did you ever do that?
Yeah, it's the most boring thing in the world. I have no debt.
I think I did it once, but then it didn't really tell me anything. And so I was like, eh, okay.
The So the way the credit report works is it doesn't just reflect the bad debt, it reflects the stuff that you're paying regularly too. So for example, my MTN bill was there, and it gets paid by debit order every month, but it's there, like, hey, we billed him, hey, he paid, what a good, you know,
what a good boy.
So you would see it there because you would see someone reflecting that the debt was being paid, or more likely if someone's, you know, I mean, why did they use your name to get debt and then
I was just
pay?
Saying, like, what a considerate criminal taking out debt in your name and upping your credit
Maybe
score.
They'll send you bubbles after. So most likely what you would see, and that's a good point, and it's one of the reasons why I do occasionally just pop in to see what's happening there, is one, just, you know, maybe someone's claiming something that's just frankly fake, just not true. Now, my worry is I once got a judgment put against my name and they had made a mistake. And I'm like, and this is way back, and it was like early 2000s, and it was a complicated process. And I like, yo, hang on, this isn't my judgment. I tried to, must have been 98 or something. Anyway, I was trying to get a loan for something. I think I was buying my house in 98, and suddenly I couldn't because I had a judgment, and I'm like, I know nothing about this judgment. And it had been incorrectly put on my credit report. It wasn't my judgment. It wasn't aimed at me. So I'm looking at it for that, and I'm looking to see if there's stuff that I don't recognize. Like, really, there should be some credit cards and a cell phone bill, and that's about it.
So identity theft used to be, a few years ago, that used to be like the big way that people got you. It's just like they would steal your identity and then do all sorts of stuff in your name, like get married. And
yeah, so it's still fairly prevalent, less so because Home Affairs, we were talking before we came on air, Home Affairs used to be like a sieve, like you know, ID documents went out all the doors and the windows and probably some through tunnels and stuff. And that's largely been resolved. So what you would do is you go get an ID book in the name of Christia van Heerden and boogie off and you know, fake some stuff, etc. But now it's much harder to do in the way that they, I mean, just Fika in of itself, in the way that they do Fika and that sort of thing. I mean, one of the reasons you can take a selfie and do Fika now is that they hit the database and there's a photograph of you there and they compare and they want a 75% match. Now, someone who's stealing your identity who's never met you doesn't know how to match you.
Well, unless your brother steals your identity and you guys look exactly the same. Your twin brother can steal your identity.
I mean, you and your brother need to chat.
luckily, my brother looks nothing like me, so I'm safe. My mom does look quite a lot like me, so she could do it.
Put it this way. If someone lent money to you, think to your mother thinking it was you, that, no.
Okay, so what do you do if you feel like you have debt, but the way that they are expecting you to pay back your debt is unfair?
So you got the debt legitimately. Then you need, I mean, I'm assuming that when you got the debt, there was a T's and C's and you agreed to those T's and C's. They said you will pay X rand a month for so many months. And then you discovered that doesn't quite work for whatever reason. You were over optimistic, you couldn't cut back on the bubbles, or you,
or
whatever.
Lost your job,
or something like that. Then approach them, and approach them quick. Because the last thing, someone's lent money. What do they want? They want that money back, and they want their interest. And they would like it back in the time that was agreed upon. But second prize to them is get the money and the interest over a longer period. In other words, negotiate T's and C's. And we see Capitec results out today, and they will roll loans. So you took a 36-month and you can't make it work, so they'll move it to a 60-month. That's a terrible idea, but, you know, don't just sort of stop paying or short paying. Contact the lender and say, can we negotiate terms that are more favorable to me, and play open cards with them. Say, you know what, I drink too many bubbles and I can't afford this. okay, not that part, but play open cards and say to them, I can't do what I promised to do. What can we do about it? And I mean, almost every time they're going to say, sure, how about this? It's going to cost you more because you're going to pay over a longer period. You're going to pay more interest, but you can negotiate with them, and they will, because what they don't want is you in default. They don't want to have to send collection agencies after you.
About 5 months ago, we got approached by a collection agency called Vericred, and they said to us, they really would like for us to develop some information around what your rights are and how it works when you get handed over.
Yeah.
Which sounded like a good idea because it happens to a lot of people. And actually, the person who owns the company said she once had debt that she forgot about and then she got handed over. So it's like it really can happen to anybody. But in that process of developing that information, I've learned so much about what your rights are when you get handed over specifically. Like, when I was in a lot of debt and I got handed over, it was like the end of the world to me. I was like, oh dear, now everything is going to fall apart and I'm bankrupt and whatever. But what I learned is that actually debt collection agencies specifically, so let's say you didn't get in contact with the person that you owed money to, they handed you over to a debt collection agency. Those agencies are allowed sometimes to negotiate on behalf of the person that you owe, or the company that you owe money to, and they can sometimes give you a discount on your debt, sometimes as much as 20%, which is not an insignificant number. The flip side of being handed over, so it's not like always great news when you're handed over, because the flip side is every time they contact you as a debt collection agency, they leave, there's a little fee that gets charged on top of your debt that goes to the debt collection agency, because that's how they make money. And so that process, once you've been handed over, like if you handle that process well, you can reduce your debt by a significant amount. You can renegotiate your repayment periods, but you have to engage with those people like the minute they call you. Do not avoid that phone call. Do not ask them to call you back later, because if you answer the phone and you say, call me back later, they
charge you
again. Yeah.
And don't even get to that point. Just make it, you know, just make sure that if you know when you're sliding on debt, you know what you owe, you know what your requirements are. If you're sliding, contact them ASAP. You know, if you've got a debit order going off on Friday and it's going to bounce, phone them on Wednesday and say, hey, you're going to hit me in a debit order. It's not going to work.
What about consolidation?
Yeah, so at some point, if you've got too much debt scattered around, the plan is that then you consolidate. So you get one single big loan and you pay off all your small loans.
Hopefully with a low interest rate.
So there's a couple of issues. What they'll do, and hopefully, is give you a lower rate and perhaps even a longer term. So, you know, you might not save money, but you might also avoid getting handed over or anything such like that. And that can work. It also is part of... when you go into debt counseling, that's often a consolidation process. It's a late step in the process. You really should be managing this long before you get to there. I mean, you know, very few people, if you lose a job or something really like gigantic happens that hits your finances, mostly you're going to see this slide into it's not working. Although truthfully, then you're probably also, you know, you might be sticking your head in the sand and hoping it goes away or that someone buys you a lotto ticket, a winning lotto ticket. But you can do a debt consolidation. In other words, go, you know, one provider, I know someone who did it on, they rebonded their house and got a couple of $100,000 extra in their home loan to then clear all their debt. Two issues. Rebonding your house costs money. The mistake that they then made was then they paid off everything. Nice, but they didn't close his account. So what did they do? They ran those debts up again. So because it was store cards and credit cards and Willie's cards and all of that. So they paid them down to zero, and then they're like, yo, be rich, and they blew it. So now they were back in debt and had a bigger home loan.
This is the problem with debt, is that you have to sort out the behavior that got you into the debt, which is why I think when I got into so much debt, like the most important financial lessons I learned was in the process of paying off the debt, because I realized how important it was to reduce my living expenses. I realized how much interest I was paying. I realized the snowball method, et cetera, et cetera. But because I went through that process of slowly paying off the debt, I learned all of those lessons. I think sometimes when you consolidate the debt, it makes it seem like such a simple solution to the problem, and then you don't really learn the lessons and you just keep making the same mistakes.
I mean, none of this resolves the issue that you took debt, couldn't handle it, therefore you have a problem with managing money, and that doesn't go away just because you get more money or get the debt cleared.
If you need help with debt consolidation, and if you need debt counseling and stuff, you can go to the National Credit Regulator website, and they've got people that they recommend who can help you with this process, like professionals who deal with this.
And you're not going into receivership or personal bankruptcy or whatever. I can't remember what the local phrase is. But not everyone is applicable, et cetera, but there is a formal process that goes through, and they will help you in this process.
So you guys can go to ncr.org.za, and they will put you in touch with the right people to help you with this process. Yeah,
and if you currently owe less than 50,000 and your income is less than 7,500, there is a law that's just been signed in, which will perhaps just wipe it out, make it go away.
Whoa. But again, this is it's you're going to have the same issue. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is when you've paid off your accounts, and I think sometimes people don't realize this, when you still have an open account with credit available, even if you don't owe anything, they still charge you an account fee on that account, and you still pay you pay interest on those account fees if you don't pay the account fees. So when you've paid off your debt, it's not enough to cut up the card and to prevent yourself from going to the shop. You actually have to go there and close the account down completely. Otherwise, you're still going to pay to have an open account with credit
and
available.
And it's most usually significantly harder to close an account than open an account.
Oh, yeah. I wonder, do you think it's better to, let's say that you feel like you can't live without debt.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's better to have like one credit card where you pay everything, or do you think it's better to then have your store accounts that you hit? Because I want to say, because the thing is, you end up in the same place, right? You are using credit to pay for stuff, whether you have an Edgar's account and buy things there, or whether you have a credit card to buy things at Edgar's.
Yeah, so I think two things. So often some of the store cards are 6 months free. In other words, you don't pay interest. And I don't know if that has changed, but when I used to have them in the 90s, as long as you paid them off over a 6 month. So if you bought a 600 rand pair of pants and you paid $100 a month, you didn't pay any interest on it. But that aside, it depends on A, the interest rate, so which is better, and credit cards are not cheap either. But also, having an Edgar's card, I mean, my wife and I had a Woolies credit card, and then we were deeply poor. So here we were deeply poor, but living on Woolies food, because it's all we had.
That happened to me too.
Yeah. So the problem with that is that you're hooked into buying an Edgar's, and maybe those jeans are cheaper down the road, but you've got an Edgar's card. So there's the lack of flexibility in a store card. And the other biggie is, quite simply, is just the lack of lack of interest rates in terms of what are they?
Mm.
You know, again, it's the spreadsheet answer. What does it cost?
Yeah. So some credit cards, like I have a Virgin Money credit card, and they've got a 55-day interest-free period.
Yes.
It's weird with credit cards, though, because it's not like, okay, you bought something, and for 55 days, that thing that you bought is interest-free. It's to do with the billing cycle. So you have 55 interest-free days within a billing cycle. And once, so it means if you bought something on day 54.
Yes, you got 1 day.
You've got 1 day of interest-free. And I've never been able to figure that out entirely. Like, I don't know when my cycle starts or ends, and it doesn't really reflect on my statement, so it's difficult to do. So I just settle the whole outstanding amount every month, just in case, because it has triggered an interest payment for me before. Like 1 month I didn't do that because I didn't understand.
Yeah, I could never work out, and that was including me working at the bank and going to the person who runs credit card division and saying, how does this work? And an hour later say, you know what, don't worry.
So I phoned them one day, and the call center person said to me, you've got 30 days from when they send you the statement. So they don't send you a statement every 30 days. I think they send you a statement every however many days. And then you've got 30 days from the statement to settle your account. And then the cycle starts over. That's what I could get from it. But I don't know if that's true even.
I don't know.
Okay, what do you do if you want to take on more debt but you can't? Do you have anything, can you go anywhere to help?
Loan sharks.
Oi.
No, and I only say that because it's a true answer, but that's not, I mean, like, you know, when you go to a loan shark, you may as well just take your kidney in a little plastic bag and say, look, here's my kidney.
Pre-cut it out.
Because, like, well, you're going to cut it out more carefully than they are, aren't they? They're not going to care about aesthetics and your beach body and all of that sort of thing. No, if you can't get debt, then it's friends, families and fools and loan sharks.
Can you get debt in somebody else's name? Can you ask somebody else to take on debt for you?
Ah, no. Well, you could. What you could do is get someone to stand surety for the debt.
How does that work?
So you take.
I've heard about that, but so I've
you
never
take,
actually
you
seen
take
it in
out
practice.
The debt. You're liable for it, but if you default, I've promised to cover it.
But you can't do that for like store accounts and stuff. That's for home loans and student loans and stuff like that.
Yeah, so not for a store account, no. But for any, I mean, any bank loan or anything like that, and I've often had it, where someone can't get the credit, the bank won't give it to them. So the bank says, well, go get someone to stand surety. And they want me to stand surety. And I'm like, hang on a second. The bank won't lend you money, and now you want me to backstop you. Like not happening.
Mm.
But so certainly. So somebody, and it can be anyone, it doesn't need to be family or related to anything, somebody can stand surety and say, if they default, you can come after me.
Sure. Don't do that.
No, don't do that. And, I mean, yeah, if you can't get debt, then and maybe there's a good reason in that you just don't have a credit record like that. Like, who are you? I'm this person. But typically, I mean, your bank and stuff. I mean, so like a home loan's fairly simple. Assuming you have the deposit and you're buying within your means, your bank will lend you money. Now, the issue becomes at what rate and that sort of thing. They're not going to, because it's a fixed asset, they can go over your house. As it becomes a motor vehicle, it's less of a fixed asset. When it just becomes an unsecured sort of credit card or personal loan, then they're like, And partly they then rip you on the fees. Mm. But if you can't get debt, if you can't take on... So the question, and if you can't get more debt, well, then you've got too much.
Mm. I have a friend whose sister once asked him, so she got into a bunch of debt and then she couldn't pay it, and then she asked him to pay it. And he said, cool, give me the account details of the things that I need to pay. And she's like, no, give me the money and then I'll pay it. And he's like, bro, no way.
Yeah.
All right. What about, let's move on to savings. So our rights, when you've got savings that get stolen, like what happened to you the other day, what do you do?
Contact the institution and probably contact, well, in this case, it was my credit card. So there's a magic telephone number that comes in the SMS, phone it ASAP. And also my banking app, I can go into my app and cancel the card. But so I get SMSs on any transaction, I think over 100 Rand. And in that SMS, there's a thing that says, if this looks dodge, here's a number, phone us.
Okay. So I know that with banks like Capitec, when you go through your bank account and you see a debit order that is not yours, you can report it as fraudulent, and then they reverse the charge and they give you the money back.
Yes.
Which is something that you can do. However, I know that people also do this when they've committed to pay something and they don't feel like paying it anymore.
That's fraud.
And that is not legal. You shouldn't do that. It's really, really bad for your credit record as well.
Yeah, well, it's also fraud. The institution which sold you the product, you have a legal agreement with them, and you've now breached your side of that agreement.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think most of the banks these days allow you to reverse debit orders online under a certain amount.
What about if you have a lot of cash that somebody had stolen? Is there anything you can do?
So phone the police, go to the police, and if that doesn't work for you, go to the loan shark's friend. The oka was going to take your kidney
the
out.
The burly man with the baton.
With the shears. I did a favor for a tow truck driver once and saved his ass in a bad option trade. And he gave me his number and said, if ever you need anything. And I'm like, yeah. And he said, anything. So in my phone, there's Ed, tow truck driver, anything. So like, if you do that to me, I'm phoning Ed, hey? Because like, when my car got scammed, you phone Standard Bank and you tell him everything and you explain to them how come... Yes, you were in Cape Town on Thursday, but you're not in Cape Town anymore on Saturday. You have to explain airplanes and flights and all those sort of things to them. And then it goes off to the fraud division and they investigate. Truthfully, they do all. It's just cheaper to pay it. And then a few days later, so remember, they take a hold. The money hasn't left the account. It's just on a hold. And then like on the Wednesday, suddenly the money leaves. Boom. And I'm like, the f***. And then boom, like a second later, fraud reimbursement payment thingy, match.
So if you've got, let's say you've got a family member who stole some cash from you, and you go to the police and you say, this is how much money was involved. This person took this money. What would the police do in that
situation? In a perfect world, the police would investigate. And unfortunately, so in a perfect world, they would investigate. They would interview yourself. They would interview the person who's being accused. They would look around for evidence. Like, you claim you gave them 10,000 rand cash. Is there evidence that you drew 10,000? Is there evidence that they spent 10,000, et cetera, et cetera? And then if it is that they were stolen, that the money was stolen, then they would put criminal charges for theft against you. In that case, you could also just do a personal, just put your own claim in. And if it's under a certain amount, and I don't know how much, you can go to small claims court. Otherwise, you've got to go to big court and get a lawyer and everything else. And you can just put sue them.
Can you bypass the police and just sue them?
You can bypass the police. Yeah, but always, so what a police statement does, even if you don't have expectation of anything happening, is it gives you a record, an affidavit. So, let's say I claim that I lent you 50,000 and you haven't paid it back, and I take you to court. The judge is going to say, well, where's the proof? And now part of the proof would be I made you sign a contract, and part of the proof would be bank records. But part of that proof could also be, well, I went to the police and claimed that she stole the money. So he has an affidavit from a policeman and a case number and all of that sort of thing. Even if they haven't investigated, it gives you a record and an affidavit and all those sort of important things.
What about if you've invested money or you've put money into a savings account, but you're not getting what you promised? So remember a while back there was a bank who said you get 13% interest on a savings account, and it turns out it was 13% compounded and not whatever. And so you were, they didn't say anything illegal because kind of sort of it is true, but it's also not really.
Now they
true.
Just put an asterisk, and then they. So a couple of things there. You complain vigorously to the bank. You can complain to the. So processes like this are usually, you got to complain internally first to the internal structures, and they will have procedures and individuals and departments, etc., who will review the complaint and make a decision. Then, if you don't like their decision, you go to the ombud.
Is that the FSCA in this case?
No, there's a banking ombud. So the FSCA sits separate to all. We've got an insurance ombud and a banking ombud. In fact, there's a short-term and then a long-term insurance ombud and a banking one, etc. You then go to the ombud and put your claim into them, and they will make a decision. That is, in that case, then binding. But something like that, which is misleading advertising, you can also just fun, go to the Advertising Standards Authority. You won't get anything back, but you might make them look like a little bit red-faced. Mm. And stuff like that. I mean, if you've got enough Twitter followers or something, well, remember that chap who released snakes in an Absa branch?
No?
Yeah, he was pissed off about it.
In an ineffective way to get anything done.
Well, except I'm talking about him right now, aren't I? And Absa's like, shh, we don't talk about that. No, they're patently not doing that.
I just cracked myself up so hard.
There always is process. And just quickly, if you have this with a stockbroker, you go to your stockbroker, then you go to the JSC, and then you go to the FSCA. And that's the one time the FSCA comes in, and there is three levels. Otherwise, there's typically two levels. And for example, the motor industry has a motor industry body who, not from personal experience, but from stories from friends, is about only slightly less useless than a dead snake. A dead snake, you could make
it. Were the snakes dead?
No, they weren't. Those weren't. And I'm thinking a dead snake's actually useful, right? You could make a handbag or have a sandwich or something. There are a lot of, oftentimes they're industry bodies, but oftentimes they're toothless, oftentimes they're useless, and oftentimes the person, so you have a bad, your car repair was bad. And you go to the body and they're like, oh no, those people don't belong to us. Sorry, nothing we can do.
So I had the same thing with my house because the estate agent who sold me my house just lied through his teeth, like a lot.
Yeah, but that, hold on, when you're a state agent, that's not called lying, that's called selling.
It's called doing your job. So I looked at the, because there's an industry body for estate agents where you can complain about them. So then I looked at that process, and they basically say on the homepage of this industry body, they're like,
don't waste our time.
No, they're like, this is going to take at least 6 weeks. So if you submit something, don't contact us for 6 weeks. We will get back to you if we feel like it. And if we don't, we won't. I was like, all right, well, I'm just not even going to bother.
So even 6 weeks, I mean, banking on both those folks, I mean, they're taking months, partly because they're understaffed, because the industry doesn't. Would rather, I mean, I know industry plays lip service, but the industries would rather the umbut goes away, and they're underfunded and stuff. So 6 weeks is not bad.
Yeah, it was more than, because it's 6 weeks after months and months of fighting and back and forth.
Yeah, and the trick is, and I mean, to your point, is it, so how do you, so my estate agent, I've bought three houses and sold two, so I've had five estate agents in my life. I've had five estate agents lie to me, so I'm 5 for 5. And the last oak, I mean, I caught him lying, so I tried to get him to do it in writing. He was too clever.
Yeah.
So how do I prove?
They know how to skirt the boundaries.
Yeah, how do I prove that he lied to me when it was me and him in the unit and no witnesses, and he's like, I didn't say that.
All right, so what about when you have insurance, but your insurance company isn't paying out for the things that they said they would pay out?
So again,
which is like every insurance claim ever in the world.
Yeah, so weirdly in my life, I've never not had a claim paid. I mean, I had an all-risk policy in my laptop. This is early 2000s. I'm leaving for Joburg at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I spill coffee in my laptop, and of course it dies. So I put the claim in, and I'm wondering, what shall I say? And then I said, I spilled coffee. And they're like, oh, here's the money. So again, there will be an internal process to the insurance company. So they reject your claim, or they underpay your claim, or something like that. They have to state reasons. You don't like or agree with the reasons. There will be an internal compliance/umbut process. And if you're not happy with that, then there's an umbut long or short term. And they are required to tell you how this works. They are required to tell you who the umbut is and how to contact them, etc., etc. So your first port of call is always to go back to the person who has, in your mind, done you wrong. You go to them, you give them a chance to review and to correct their error of their ways and to see the light and all of that. If they decline to see the light, then you go to an umbut person. At that point, if you lose, you're off to the courts.
Okay. Okay, let's say you've touched on investments as well. So fraudulent investments, pyramid schemes. Let's talk about those first, and then we can talk about losing money and bad market conditions and bad returns and stuff.
So fraudulent investments, pyramid schemes, that sort of thing. Frankly, it's police, because I mean, you can go to the FSCA. They can issue warnings. I mean, I'm on their mailing list, and a couple.
Oh, it's scary. Yeah, it's very scary.
Regularly, you get these emails. So and so
every Friday, at least four.
And you know, that horse is bolted, right? Like by the time they, you know, so what you need, so you can go to the FSA and lodge your complaint, and if they've gotten a license, it will be taken away from them, and there will be a thing issued against them, and the FSA can issue fines and has in the past issued fines, etc. But if you want your monies back, go to that loan shark friend Oak or Ed the tow truck driver. And otherwise you go to the police.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I once did a story on this guy who ran a pyramid scheme and then got shut down. And then like, he just keeps popping up like a bad mushroom basically. Mm. So it's the same guy. So I get called in, I did a story for FinWeek about it. Then the FECA call me in, and there's this like process which was very scary and made me feel like a criminal, even though I didn't do anything wrong, wasn't even invested in the thing. And then they say to me, look, this guy keeps coming back and he's got a new scam every few years. It's the same dude. So somebody mailed us 2 weeks ago, I don't know if you remember, about the same guy with a whole brand new scheme, and it's always related to property in this guy's case. So be careful of property syndications and stuff. It's scary. But this guy is not locked up. He's not, like, he's making money from people because he keeps stealing money from people, but he's not in jail.
It's there are a couple of points. A, it's very, very hard. Oftentimes, the monies are moderately small. You know, if you steal 100 million, man, they're going to find you and, like, you know, get the money back. But if you've stolen, you know, 100K from 1,000 people, it, you know, you've got to get 1,000 statements, etc. Our police are under-resourced. Oftentimes, I mean, I remember with the Ref Wayne and Pipcoin chatting with people at the NDPP, and they just didn't understand crypto. And in fact, they wanted me and Petri to go in and just to help to teach them about crypto.
What's the NDPP?
National Director of Public Prosecutions, Shamil Batoy. So it was pre-Shamil's time. But anyway, so they didn't understand crypto. And so they didn't understand the scam that, you know, I mean, and et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, when I think about the scams that I have come across over the years, I can't think of a single person who's gone to jail. And I mean, the rumors are that the National Prosecuting Authority wanted to talk to Ref Wayne, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, there's no evidence that he's been charged or anything like that. And mostly peeps get away with it.
So my parents lost a lot of money in a pyramid scheme when I was younger, and those people actually went to jail. It took the thing collapsed in 2002, and they went to jail in 2015.
Yeah,
they lost in the pyramid scheme 1.5 billion rand in 4 years.
Your parents didn't lose the 1.5 billion. The crooks did. I'm thinking you'd be a little sadder if your parents had lost.
That's hilarious.
I mean, so there's the man who did the, what's his name? He's always on MoneyWeb. He did the scam with the other chap in the early 2000s. Perot, something. And this, I mean, Jack Milne has been to jail, served his time, and got out of jail a decade ago. And Perot and the other lady, Sally Burnett, is still wandering their way through courts.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right. What about if you made an investment and then you lose money? So just like ordinary, and you bought EOH.
Buyer be warned.
All right. What does that mean?
When you buy something, you might, if you're making an investment, that can go up, and as you know, so it, you know,
is it the responsibility of the JSE or of the broker or whatever to tell you that this could happen?
It depends on the relationship that you have with the broker. So if it is an advisory broker and they say we suggest that you buy this, et cetera, et cetera, and it collapses, you can then at the broker level make lodge complaints, etc. And I've seen those, and most of the case, you know what, no one's, you know, as long as the broker did it in good faith and as long as the broker did it within mandate and all of that sort of thing, it is buyer beware. I have seen one instance, and in particular it was with Warren. So an old lady gave somebody in Durban, and he was a registered, he was a category 2 advisor, so he could transact on her behalf. She was retired, so in her 60s, and she had whatever, and she gave him like R1 million as a 60-year-old lady and said, look, you know, be careful with this. And he put it into warrants. He didn't understand the warrants, and he basically lost 100% of it.
Oh, dear.
And she then complained, and it went before courts and all of that sort of thing. It was some process, because I was an expert witness, and he lost, and because they were like, hang on, the 65-year-old lady says this is all the money I have, please make me an income and be careful, and you went and bought a warrant and you don't know what theta or delta or vega is, like the fact, like, you breached that mandate. If you are on a DIY platform where it's you buying, you've got very little, except. So Steinhoff, as an example, there is a class action suit happening, and you could have joined that class action suit as a defrauded shareholder.
Okay.
But Steinhoff's different, because there's out and out fraud. I mean, Marcus Huerta is many things, and none of them are polite or nice. Whereas, you know,
EOH.
Yeah. I mean, there is a little bit there, but it's not on the same level. You know, yeah.
So I think what's interesting, and this is something that we often, I don't think we stress this enough. I think that people kind of know this, but they don't often think about it, is that when you buy a share in a business, what you really are doing is you're investing in a business. You're buying into a business.
Like Joe's Pizza Parlor.
Right. And you need to keep in mind that the risks that you would have had if you had started that business by yourself are the risks that you would face as a shareholder in that business, because that's essentially what it is.
You're doing. And there's a risk. You know, so let's take Joe's Pizza Parlor. What are the risks of Joe's Pizza Parlor? Well, the risks are that Joe's a crook. The risks are that the pizzas are terrible. The risks are that the location sucks. The risks are that there's a better pizza parlor down the road. There are risks galore that could all see Joe's Pizza Parlor end up being a bad investment or, at worst case, going to zero.
Yeah. Devet, one of our tax elves, sent me an article by a lawyer at Cliff Dacker Hofmeyer, which is a law firm, where somebody had taken, so get this, somebody gave a financial advisor 5 million rand, and that advisor had invested the money in ShareMax. Do you remember we did a thing about ShareMax, that property syndication? Yeah. And then the property syndication fell flat, and the person who had given the 5 million lost all of their 5 million, and then they sued the financial advisor. And so this process went through the courts, and it was really interesting to see, because in this article, they basically take you through the process and how the court thinks about this. And so the court is like, did you have enough time to make the decision, is one of the things. And they had evidence that said there were 2 weeks between when the advisor made the recommendation and when the person signed the contract, right? So obviously 2 weeks is enough time to think about whether or not you want to make an investment. And then, did the advisor give you all the right documentation? Did the advisor understand the product himself? So in this case, the advisor also had money invested in the scheme. And so the court found for the advisor.
Yeah.
And this is, it's a really interesting article because it shows you how that process works and kind of what all the things are that you have to look out for. Do you have enough time? Do you have all the information? Does the advisor understand the information? So basically the court was like, you know, bro, you shouldn't have put your 5 million rand into a product.
Yeah. And in this case, you know, and in this case, I want to truthfully throw the advisor under the nearest bus that we can find. But, you know, stuff happens. And it can an advisor, I mean, the option then is like, well, put your money in a bank and please God don't make it VBS. So then it's put your money under the mattress. I mean, you've got to take a level of risk. There is going to be fraud. There is going to be going down. The advisor certainly, I think, needs to have a fair amount of what's knowing and knowledgeable. But ShareMax was, I mean, ShareMax took, you know, billions and billions of peeps' money. It's still unwinding and messy and everything else. And a lot of smart people were duped by it. That said, a lot of smart people weren't duped by it and were I want to say warning against it, but were certainly cautious of it.
But this is, ShareMax wasn't a listed property.
No. And that's the point.
And so this is, there's a degree of safety that you can build in because of those processes that you explained earlier. Like you can go via the JSE and then you can go via the FECA, et cetera, et cetera. Those processes are built in and the JSE has insurance for when things go horribly wrong and your stockbroker has insurance.
Well, if your stockbroker's a crook, but not if the company.
So there's a process when you go into a listed instrument that provides a level of safety that over-the-counter stuff does not provide. And this is something that you have to keep in mind. And if you're going around throwing around 5 million rand at a time, you have to understand this process. You know, that's like, and this is why I often think it's bad when somebody gets a big amount of money, like inherits it or whatever, because you don't have that time. It's the same as with the date that I was saying earlier. You don't have the time to learn this. And now you're walking around with millions of rands and putting it into instruments that you don't understand, that don't have any
securities. So interestingly, I got an email a week or so ago, someone who's inherited, she didn't say the amount, but it was, she said it's an eye-wateringly large amount. And she said her response is she wants to just put it in a bank for a year and think about this. I'm like, cool, not bad. So there are a couple of things. I mean, firstly, you know, there's points that I've got that would be red flags, but how does the person in the street know these? So my first thing is I only buy listed. And that doesn't mean you don't get Steinhoffs and African banks and everything else, but it does give me an extra layer of oversight from the JSC, which, you know, because the Companies Act is fine, but the JSC kind of makes sure that you're following the Companies Act. It also gives me lots of eyes on that company. If I know Joe's Pizza, if I'm a co-owner in Joe's Pizza Parlor, me and Joe are the only ones looking at the numbers, and I'm not an accountant, and if Joe's a crook, I'm not going to notice. Whereas here, you've got lots of people looking at Steinhoff. There were people who were saying, this is dodge, this is not good. Others were just saying, we're not sure, stay away. You've got those extra eyes. So I only invest in listed. I don't do unlisted ever, never have, hope to never. That's why you diversify, which is an ETF. Like, you don't want one share, because if everything you've got is in ShareMax and it's a scam, then you're out of business. And check those returns. You know, if the market is doing, call it 12%, and someone's doing 20, the question is how?
And for how long?
Yeah, and particularly, you know, so globally, in capitalist countries, the best performing asset class is the equity market. That is always the case. If someone is promising you a return ahead of the equity market, the question is how? Particularly if they are guaranteeing a return ahead of the equity market, then the question is how are you doing the crookery? Because that's, I mean,
where is the money coming from? Yeah. How are you growing?
You know, and what happens is my mother-in-law fell for this. She was guaranteed, and I forget the number, call it 20%. And I'm like, but the market's only doing 12. And she's like, oh, but it's a guarantee. And I'm like, but they can't make that guarantee. I mean, how? Anyway, it turned out that she had misunderstood. The guarantee was you'll get your money back. You know, in other words, you know, you won't lose money. And it was a structured-y, product-y type of thing. But you can't, if you're guaranteeing 20%, like, and you're not robbing banks, how?
So this is what I'm kind of taking from this conversation is if you've never invested before in your life, you're just starting on this journey, you've got some debt, et cetera, et cetera. The odds that you are going to find the next over-the-counter investment that is going to make you supremely rich over Simon, over me, over everybody else who listens to this podcast, it's not great.
No. Like, it's actually zero.
Yeah. So learn how to work within the system. Once you've figured out what's going on within the system, let us know, because we don't know. And then you can look at these alternative stuff. And this is always what I'm saying with all these blueberries and bitcoins and all of that stuff as well. First, work within the system and then go and try and find money elsewhere if you really feel like you're now bored of the system. Because when it comes to debt, the minute you go outside of the system, you have no protection.
Yeah.
When it comes to basically all of the stuff that we've spoken about, investments and advice and stuff, the minute you go outside of the formal system, there's nobody there to protect you. There's nobody there to help you.
Yeah. It's just... And if you're trying to get rich in a hurry, there's one way you do it. You marry money.
Like, even that, man.
Well, no, if you marry right and get no ANC contracts and shit, like you find a rich person and marry them in a community of property and then push them under a bus.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is what we advise on this part.
Oh, no. We don't advise it.
Financial advice from Simon Brown.
That's not advice. That's just the only way you get rich in a hurry. No other way.
Yeah.
And that's not without risks.
Yeah, look, it's just color within the lines. This is like what people often say this about art. They're like, you have to learn all the basics of art before you can become like a savant and basically do your own thing and, you know, flout the rules and stuff. Like Picasso didn't start out with all his abstract stuff. He also just drew like a picture like anybody else for a long, long time before he started doing that.
Yeah.
And it works the same with your investments. Don't try and be a hero.
And we always hear the story of the person who found some little stock and bought it at 2 cents and sold it at a gabillion cents. And, you know, I tell my Capitec story every chance I got. But two honest points around that. Firstly, those stories are so rare, they're not even the exception. I mean, they make hen's teeth look like a popular pastime. Hen don't have teeth, I assume, eh?
You hope.
I the only time I see hens is on Sunday roasts, so they're of no problem to me. And equally true about that is that if I had taken my entire net worth at that point and put it in Capitec, I would not be here today.
You would be a fool.
well, I would be a fool. I would have made so much money. The point is, I would have taken my entire net worth and put it into MoldMed or 100 other companies before that, and I would have lost my entire net worth long before I found Capitec.
So here's the thing. I always think about Magda Insignia, right? She is the richest woman in the country because she started a business and she did it incredibly well, right? And nobody can take that away from her. What are the odds that I would be able to take my energy and my efforts to build another Signia? It's not amazing, right? Like everybody, like she's not the first person to leave a brokerage firm and start her own thing.
Yeah.
She is one of the few people who actually made it work, right? I don't think that I am anything special, and I don't think that I can give Magda a run for her money ever, right? So I'm not gonna try that. Would it be a better investment if I put all my money into the next Signia and became Magda? Yes, it would be. What are the odds that I can do it? Zero. I want to say.
And there's another point, and I've talked about this before. Nassim Taleb writes about this in his first book, Fooled by Randomness. With all respect to Magda, she did an amazing thing, but she also had some luck along the way. Mm. And we discount that out. Mm. Buffett had luck along the way, and we discount it out.
Even your Capitec had luck.
No, my Capitec, I mean, I didn't want, I'd been watching them go up and up and up, and my colleague at Standard Bank was teasing me for not having bought them. So in like a fit of like, I'll show you, I bought them. And then they carried on going up, and I bought more, and they never stopped. I mean, it was dumb luck. Mm. And we discount that. I mean, so can you be the next Magda? Sure. Your odds, yo, man, it makes the lotto look like a good investment.
So this is the thing about ETFs, is that if you hold a top 40, eventually you also hold the Capitec.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hold the EOH, eventually you stop holding the EOH, right?
Like you never held the EOH. It was never a top 40 stock.
But you know what I mean, right? Or the Steinhoff. Like eventually you stop holding it. So you don't need to rely so much on the luck part of it or the skill part of it. And that's what makes it easier to do. That's why I prefer it and why I only do that. All right. Is there anything else you want to add about your rights as a person in the world who is often the victim of financial foolery?
So oddly enough, from all of my financial foolery, I haven't lost a single penny yet. Ooh, touch wood. Sail some Hail Marys. So aside from the fact of be realistic, etc., I had a great thought and it left.
Oh, yes, because you thought about losing those pennies. Okay, let's
like I got
along.
Seven of them, and I'm like so scared of losing them. There is no secret or shortcut to wealth creation.
You know what? It might also be worth saying, maybe it's just stating the obvious, but when you get a contract, read it.
Yeah.
Read it carefully.
And we have a law in this country which says contracts need to be plain English, and it's quite astounding that they are. I mean, my current, like 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm not sure what to do and my eyes are wide open because of midnight expressos, you go read Acts of Parliament and they're in English. Mm. Like no more, okay, sometimes you need magnifying glasses, but that's what you got a Zoom function in your computer. Mm. You know, read it. And if you're not sure and stuff, you know, poke around and extract yourself out if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Our win of the week this week is Heloise, who could relate to our Rookie Errors podcast. Shame, Heloise. We all can. We all made all of those mistakes. She says, I've just finished the latest episodes, just in case you were wondering how far behind we are, the latest episode highlighting rookie mistakes, and I've made a big one. Earlier this year, I moved from my company who provided a provident fund with Momentum to a company that doesn't include a retirement option. I decided to get an RA. Conveniently, I received a call from a third-party consultant for Discovery, where I have my medical aid. I was in a rush and obviously hadn't started listening to the Fat Wallet show yet, so I signed up for an RA with 3.5% fees, not including the consulting fees. Luckily, this only started in May, and before I completely fund somebody else's Merc, I'd like to make a move. But now I feel completely overwhelmed with where to look and not to be ripped off. Do you have any recommendations for where to open an RA and look for life and trade and disability cover?
Yeah, so I mean, these days there's loads. You want an RA that charges around a 1-ish percent, 10x, Signia, ETFSA, the ABSA one we stumbled across last week.
Even your Alan Gray one has a...
Even my Alan Gray, although there's limits and I'm at the limits and stuff, etc. Any one of those is perfectly fine. And all you do is you contact the provider you want to move to and say to them, ask them about the fees and maybe contact two or three of them and say, what are the fees? And probably find that two of them never get back to you. And if you like the fee, it's around 1% to 100 points. Say, I want to move. And hey, presto.
When you do RAs and dread and disability cover and even tax-free savings account, you do this in the same way that you would shop for insurance.
Yeah.
You contact multiple providers, you find the cheapest one, you buy that one. It also depends on whether or not you want or how involved you want to be in the process. So if you go to 10X, for example, and you can choose between, or you can choose how much risk you want to take depending on when you're planning on using mm-hmm. the money, but you don't have any control over what's inside.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to somebody like Signia or even ETFSA, you do have some control over what's inside.
I
mean, the Alan inside.
Gray, I could select what I wanted inside within the rules.
Yeah, you could select unit trusts.
Yeah, sure.
And with ETFSA and with Signia, you can select ETFs.
The Signia, I think, is unit trusts.
Maybe.
Yeah, because it's on the Alchemy platform. So because they don't have to go through the exchange, it's cheaper for them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Just go check that out. You're going to have to do a comparison. So draw up a little spreadsheet, look at what's inside, look at how involved you want to be. The dread and disability cover, make sure that you are covered for your own job, not for a job that is kind of sort of like your job, right? So not just for your ability to work, but for your own job. Otherwise, they don't pay out.
Yeah, I just don't trust those.
They are very sneaky. Yeah. Very sneaky. I mean, you shouldn't trust them.
I mean, they're going to say to me, your job is talking. So if I lose my voice, they're going to say, well, then Morse code.
Yeah.
You know, use your eyes. Flutter, flutter.
Okay, Inesh has been offered some unlisted shares and he'd like to know what we think. He says, I'm a surgeon and I've been offered shares in Cure Day Clinic in Midstream. This is one of those like little towns within towns. He says, the shares are unlisted, but I can buy in at 250,000 Rand for 2.5%. I don't know if it's 2.5% fee or 2.5% ownership.
Probably ownership. What is that times by 40? So they're looking to raise about 10 million, 250,000 for 2.5%. My gut response is I don't buy unlisted. End of story. Next question. Then the bigger issue is that if you want to go for this, which I've just Googled them. They're real. I mean, there's a photograph of them here. Of course, you know, like Joe's Pizza Parlor, is there a better one around the corner? I don't know. You want to do more due diligence than you are able to. In other words, you want to find a certified a chartered accountant and get them to go through the numbers. You need to understand this business. So, for example, they are doing Cure Day. I'm assuming they're a day clinic then, which is, in other words, you go in the morning and you're out in the afternoon. It's light because it's cheaper because there's no overnight stay, so it's cheap, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a listed company who's in this space and they are failing. All the big companies, Life Health, et cetera, are trying to move into this space because the insurers quite like it because it's cheaper. You know, this is not a brainer. Now, the question comes from a doctor who might well then be working there, which in one sense is, well, great, you get an idea of what's happening. In the other sense is, yeah, but then you're blinded by it as well, you know.
And it's huge concentration risk because if you're getting your income from there and that place fails, you lose your income and you lose your investment, which is huge.
And I'm not saying, you know, the trick is that this 2.5% at 250,000 one day might be worth a whole lot more. Sure, but it equally might not, you know. And if your net worth is 10 million and you're putting 250,000, why not? It's your money. It's instead of bees, you're buying into a little bit of a day clinic. If your net worth is 200K and you're putting 250 in, that's never a good idea unless that 250 is going into a savings account. Mm. I mean, it those sort of issues. And I get, so sometimes there's good reasons why these sort of things come up, where, you know, this is a day clinic, so what are they trying to do? They want to raise some money and they want to keep it in the community. They want to keep this doctor because there's many day clinics that he could utilize. They want him to utilize theirs. Well, what's one of the ways of doing that? Well, incentivize him with profit, i.e. a share of the ownership. You know, maybe there is a larger shareholder who wants out for legitimate reasons, but maybe there's a larger shareholder who wants out because there's a new day clinic being built around the corner, or there's so many unknowns. And again, it's back to why I like the listed, because in the listed, I can tick off certain things that can't be happening because there's a legal requirement, you know, around, for example, well, you can't be selling it because it's going bankrupt, because you would have had to issue a sense announcement telling me that fact. So I'm assuming it's not going bankrupt. Now, people lie on their sense announcements sometimes, but, you know, let's assume that people are following the rules. I just don't have these level of protections in this type of thing. And I'm not saying it's a terrible investment. I'm saying it's hard to know. It's incredibly hard to know. And no disrespect, but you're a doctor, and I mean, you need to find, and not just your accountant, you need to find a Keith McLachlan or an expert at valuing companies and say to them, here are the financials, what are the projections, what are the valuations, and expect to pay that person $5,000 for their time.
You did a presentation a while back, I don't know if it was a Power Hour or maybe for IG, where you talk about how you select the companies that you invest in. Can you remember what that's called?
Porter's Five Forces.
Yeah, okay. So Inesh, go onto justonelap.com and search for Porter's Five Forces, because that would give you also a sense of how to make this decision. I think that's a really good framework of how to choose whether or not you should be investing in something.
That's a great point, because it's actually a management textbook from the 80s, and don't read the book. It's like, yeah, but his concepts are really, really great. And there's one point that I add to it that's probably in the presentation, which I referred to as well. And that point is regulatory risk, which I think he doesn't touch on enough. There's a webcast. It's called Finding Awesome Stocks to Invest in from June 23, 2016. And regulatory risk as well. And certainly in the medical field, there is regulatory risk.
Okay. Megan has been retrenched, which means that there is a retrenchment package, which means tax. So she's got quite a complicated thing going on here. She says, are there any tax benefits I can claim or get with a retrenchment package? How would you suggest I go about it? Is there any way I could get more of the money in my pocket, even if it is at a later stage? So she's talking about deferring her taking on the retrenchment package. I'm not sure if I would get the money in a lump sum or in installments, and I'm not too sure how that works. She says, my plan is to settle all my debt, which is mostly a car in her case. I can then fund my emergency fund and my flip a table fund. I have a TFSA that I haven't put money into this financial year, but that's about all I have in place. I want to put money away for both my parents to say thank you to them for standing by me. My mom is in her 60s and my stepdad in his 70s. I get the feeling that I am their retirement plan, so this needs to be part of whatever I'm planning to do with the money. In the meantime, I'm doing online teaching from my apartment where I earn $10 an hour. I'm busy finishing the TEFL course, which will increase my rate by $5. So that's a new income for me. I know I can claim back a bunch of things when working from home and sorting out my own tax. Although it's a priority, it's not high up on my list. The big thing is to sort out the retrenchment package benefits and get my parents sorted and cancel debt and have my 6 months flipper table fund. So what does she do?
So a couple of things. Your retrenchment package, if it is a severance package, and I don't know the legal distinction between that, well, it can qualify as a severance benefit, and it certainly should be. There would have been a process, what, sort of 158 or something like that, part of the Labor Act, and you get paid out a lump sum. There's a special process that works, and SARS gives you a certain amount tax-free, and I want to say $500,000. So the first $500,000 you don't pay tax on, and thereafter you do pay tax on. I'm not sure that delaying it would necessarily change that. And I think maybe the question is if she's thinking about delaying it into another tax year so that her taxable income for that year is lower, etc. But as I recall, there's an amount which you get initially upfront, which is free, and then there's a special amount which they then do, and there's a form you fill in, etc., etc. So in that regard, I don't think there's a benefit to delay it, etc. Yeah. And then in terms of getting rid of debt, sure, absolutely. Now, particularly if you're going to be working for yourself, your income might be more lumpy. Try and get as much debt out. What you want to try and do is get your fixed monthly costs as low as possible. So when you have those months that lumpy down, you're still able to survive. You know, you're drinking box wine and eating beans, but all is good, as opposed to now you can't pay your bills type of scenario. And then the lumpy up months, you can squirrel money aside, etc., etc. For her parents, even at that age, assuming that they're not needing it, I mean, do they have tax-free accounts? If not, you know, stick some money into tax-free accounts.
Or maybe just into her own tax-free account for them. Because she hasn't maxed that out yet, so...
No, except, sure, but, I mean, I don't know how old Megan is, but I'm assuming that at some point she will max out her $500,000 and that she's put money in for her parents and they've passed. And so, I mean, why not get them their own? And if they've got their own, have they maxed them out?
Yeah, look, Megan, if you do this, if you get one for each of them, that's 66,000 rand that you can put in this year.
And another 66 every other year, which, take it with yours, is now 99 a year. Yeah, that's a lot of cash.
Chunky, yeah. All right, cool. I'm going to park it there because we've run out of time.
Ooh, I wasn't looking at the time.
That's it from the Just One Lap team this week. Please remember, this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you to Aiden and Kay for being our community wizards. Remember, we're at the JZ on the 31st of October.
JZ in Cape Town.
In Cape Town, doing a live Fat Wallet recording. Bring wine. My name is Chris Stephanie Eden. Thank you so much to Simon Brown. We'll catch you next week.
Bring wine.